We left off
yesterday, brethren and sisters and friends, in our review of the events of the book of Esther with the ecclesia at Shushan committing itself to prayer and fasting and seeking God's help for him to intervene in the events that would take place in the palace 3 days later. And no doubt, Esther would have found tremendous encouragement, knowing that the community was united behind her. For those who have been in a situation where they have experienced the benefits of ecclesial prayers and of prayers made on the behalf of the community for them during a time of crisis, these prayers are uniquely helpful and beneficial. Slide 36 of our handout identifies and summarizes for us the fact that Mordecai was a model for spiritual counselors. We talked about some of these things in one of the evening programs this week, so we won't spend much time on it. We've identified seven of the various steps in that exhibit. The fact that it was his genuine love for Esther that enabled him to be an effective counselor for her. He was able to crystallize the applicable principles in chapter 4 because he understood the word. But don't lose sight of the fact that when all was said and done, whatever faith Esther was going to develop out of that situation, that faith was going to be placed in God, not in Mordecai. He stepped back from the situation and left room for God to work in her life and to act in her life. He was but one means that God was using to reach Esther in this critical stage of her development. And you see the spiritual value of having counselors, having men, brethren, or sisters like Mordecai in our life that we can turn to in our time of difficulty, when we're at a crossroads in our life, which is where Esther was in chapter 4. She was at a crossroads. Who knows, Esther, whether or not you have been brought to this point in time by God to do what needs to be done? We need people around us who know the word, with whom we have the kind of relationship that will allow us to receive their counsel. And we need to be the kind of counselors to others that will help them in their time of difficulty. The other aspect that comes out of chapter 4, just before we leave it, and we've again listed some of these on the handouts, so we won't spend a great deal of time on it, but you notice how Mordecai did not ask Esther to live or to act at his level of faith. And it's critical in our interactions with each other that we not attempt to force others to live by what our faith is. Mordecai doesn't go to Esther and tell her you have no choice in chapter 4. He first brings her to the next level of faith before asking her to act in a way that will save her people. And we've got to be careful that we don't force others to try and live at our level of faith. So arranging, brethren, we don't go to the ecclesia and tell the ecclesia this is what you must do because we think it's right, without giving them the opportunity to understand what's being done from the word so that they can put their faith in the word, not in us. Husbands need to deal with their wives on the same basis. Parents need to deal with their children on the same basis when the children are old enough to understand and comprehend the principles of the word, so that when families make decisions, the children and the young people can understand that these decisions are rooted in the word and things are being done by faith. Mordecai is time and time again in the book of Esther an excellent model for parents. He has no idea, remember back in chapter 2, that Esther will grow up one day to be the queen. He didn't know how to prepare her to be the queen in terms of he didn't specifically raise her, telling her, one day, Esther, you're going to be the queen of this empire. But he did raise her in a way to understand the need, to base her actions upon godly principles. He has no idea when she is growing up in his household that one day God will put her in a position to risk her life before the king. He would have known that God puts all of us in positions in our lives where we have to choose between our own self-interest and the self-interest of others. But it's unlikely he could have ever envisioned that she would be the queen and a death sentence would be passed upon the community and she would one day have to go and appeal before the king, risking her life. But the key is that Mordecai, in raising Esther, had provided her with the spiritual foundation during her upbringing, so that when a trial like this came along, she could understand it in a spiritual context. And she could see that God is attempting to work in my life. What is it that he is asking me to do? A wonderful example for how parents ought to be teaching these same precepts to our kids. And the counsel he gives her in chapter 4 is only possible because of his love for her. How many fathers here would turn to their daughters when they're 20 or 25? She's probably in her mid-20s at this point, being on the throne 5 years. How many of us would turn to our daughters and ask our daughters to give up their life for the sake of our community? But that's what Mordecai has done. If we are punishing our kids indiscriminately, and they can't see a connection between the actions that we take in our homes and the Word of God, they won't learn to value God's chastening hand as they get older. If our actions as parents are based on natural tendencies, they won't see that it's the Bible that ought to be governing our actions. If we're not talking about how God is working in our lives when they are older in situations not unlike Esther's, how will they know to look for God to be working in their lives? Again, Mordecai is an excellent model for us as parents. Day 3 of the fast arrives in chapter 5. Esther prepares to go before the king, and the drama continues to build. She rises that morning and she doesn't know if that's going to be the last day of her life. We tend to overlook that because we go right from verse 2 to verse 3 and the question is answered. But when she gets up that morning, she is not sure if she will be living at the end of the day. In verse 1, she puts on her royal apparel. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, opposite the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne inside the palace, opposite the entrance to the palace. She is going to use her position as queen to appeal to the king. But she is not going to use her position as queen to attempt to influence the king. And we say that because it wasn't her position as queen of Persia that she was trying to protect that day. She didn't present herself to the king that morning to retain her Persian crown. She's putting it at risk. Her appeal to the king is based upon her desire for a different crown, a future crown. That future crown had become the most important crown in her life, and she's willing to give up her Persian crown for it. So don't view Esther as using her position to manipulate the king's favor. It isn't manipulation that's motivating Esther in chapter 5. It's her faith and desire for a better country, a heavenly one. It's a spiritual objective that causes her to go before the king that morning. She is standing with her people. She is not standing with the people of Persia. She's putting her career on the line, just as Mordecai had done back in chapter 3. She now has her priorities right. God comes first. What crown, brethren and sisters, do we live for? The Persian crown or the future crown? The downfall of Haman is all foretold, really in the events involving Barak and Balak, sorry, Balak and Balaam, and the Israelites back in Numbers 23 and 24. We won't take the time to go through the connections. We've offered them in the handout for your consideration. But it's interesting to note the comparisons between what Balak attempted to do in bringing down the Israelites and what Haman was attempting to do. They both were attempting to devise evil through divination. Balak in terms of asking Balaam to prophesy against Israel, and Haman in terms of casting lots to determine the day that the decree should come to a pass, and both eventually find their destruction at the hands of God. But walk with Esther that morning. When she wakes up, she puts on her royal apparel, and she goes and presents herself to the king. With her life hanging in the balance, do you notice in verse 1 that she passed right through the outer court, and she goes right into the inner court. Now, in chapter 6, when Haman comes to the king, seeking for his permission to put Mordecai to death, he comes to the outer court and he waits, because no one, absolutely no one, is allowed to go from the outer court into the inner court unless the king has first given his permission. So even mighty Haman, second in command, prime minister as he was, has to wait in the outer court, but not Esther. The king sits on his royal throne. He's still some distance away. Likely he could see the inner court, but there would be no communication between the king and Esther. There would be no opportunity for her to make an appeal and to explain to him why she was there. You can imagine her heart rate. And walk with her as she goes into the king's palace, and she goes through the outer court, and she stands now in the inner court with her life hanging in the balance. This is a real young sister who took real steps in a real palace with her life really at stake. If he fails to extend the scepter to her, she will be whisked away. Her life will end. You see, God puts us in these situations. Faith is not all mental. There comes a time when God asks us to literally take the steps of faith and do the right thing, even though it may put us in a very vulnerable or a very difficult situation. We can pray about these things. We can ask for God's help. We can confess our sin, and all of those are necessary. But there comes a time when we actually and literally have to walk the steps of faith. Once again, character is the issue. It's been 5 years since Esther was selected by the king. She now stands before him. She doesn't say a word. And once more, her character endears her to the king. And the proof of that is in verse 2, when once more she found favor, or grace is the word, in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. It's the exact same response that we read of back in chapter 2 when Esther was selected to be the queen. That which first attracted the king to her continues to. Her character was the reason she was chosen as queen. Now it is her character that will help save her people. Imagine, 5 years later, and her character has not changed. Put yourself in her position. As queen of the world, what has she had available to her? What line of credit? What stores? All the things that this world has to offer, that are so attractive to women, especially when they're in positions of that kind of power and authority. She had it all. And it didn't change her character. All the furnishings, all the nice things for the home, the closet space. She wouldn't need closets. She could have had probably homes built. All of those things that the world is attempting today to present as being the attractive items that we should seek to have. All of those things were at her disposal in unlimited supply. Most women would be overwhelmed by her position, and they would lose touch with spiritual reality. How can you maintain a spiritual focus when you have that kind of access to those kinds of things? But you see, Esther did not let her circumstances change her character. Her character hadn't changed during the year of preparation, back in chapter 2, and her character hasn't changed in the 5 years since she was made queen. So you see, our circumstances, our association with the Gentile world, they don't have to change our character. It didn't change Esther's. We may have a harsh boss. We may work in very difficult circumstances. We may have achieved great success in our careers, but it doesn't have to change our spiritual character, because it didn't change the character of this 25-year-old Jewish maiden. Do you see how critical she was in God's plan? He needed a young woman whose character would immediately endear herself to the king. And God needs, just as amazingly, this same young woman not to change over a 5-year period of time. She no doubt would have been extremely special in God's eyes, having been specifically selected for this purpose. Didn't guarantee she would respond in the right way, but an amazing individual. We don't need to let the events of our life change who we are. And for many of us in middle age, those of us who have been in careers now for 20 or 25 years, we may have achieved a measure of financial success in our jobs. Our children may be beginning to move out of the home. And you reach those high income years when you're 50 to 60 years old, the pre-retirement years, there's a lot more disposable income available in many cases. Not in all, but in many. We can have finely furnished homes. We can have multiple cars and multiple car garages. Nice vacations. But it doesn't need to change our character. And the question we need to ask ourselves, and this is especially helpful when both are in the truth, is to have that discussion with each other. Has our financial situation changed our outlook in the truth? Chapter 4 had revealed a young sister who, upon being led to the cross, as we saw yesterday, embraced it and willingly chose it and went out and lived it. You know, it's one thing for a 90-year-old brother, like Mordecai was, to be able to expound the doctrine of redemption and be able to point out what it means and why it's important for us to live it. It's something quite, again, for a 25-year-old sister to hear that discussion and go out and live what the older brother has been counseling her to do, to be willing to give it all up as she was that day. For that reason, she stands in Scripture right alongside of Joseph and David and Josiah and Daniel and the other faithful young people. She has a plan. We've outlined it in exhibit number 41 on the handout. She is not proceeding based on emotion only. You know, sometimes we can read the book of Esther, and she comes to the first banquet, and she looks around, and we think, well, the conditions just don't quite seem to be right, so I guess I'll just wait till the second banquet. That is not what's happening in the book of Esther. She has a plan. Not in the strength of her own ability, but she has thought through the chain of events. And if you look at the details, you see that. When she sends back to Mordecai, as we mentioned yesterday, there's going to be a three-day period of fasting. And when she goes before the king that morning, she has no intention of asking him for her life or the life of her people. Because she has already, as it says in verse 4, she has already prepared a banquet for him. Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come this day to a dinner that I have prepared for the king." So when he extends scepter and extends her life, there's an opportunity for her to tell him, make her request known, because he offers to give her up to half his kingdom. Unlikely that that was a literal statement, but what he's saying is, how can I help you? I've just spared your life. Now, what is it that you would like me to do? And she doesn't use that opportunity. Because we will see in the events of chapters 5 and 6, she doesn't force the issue. She leaves room for God to work in this situation. She knows what she's doing. But she will leave room for God to work. And the amazing thing is that God does. Because her plan in and of itself will not be sufficient to bring down Haman. But by her doing what she does and what she can do, God will work in her plan and intervene at just the right time so that when Esther does her part and Mordecai does his part, all the pieces are put together and God's purpose is accomplished. He is glorified. And everyone else can only stand back in awe and amazement at the wisdom and the power of our God to deliver his people. The plan begins with a three-day fast involving everyone in Shushan. And on the third day, she appears before the king. Her life is preserved, and she schedules the first banquet. Now, there's going to be a second banquet. She's going to put space in between the two. And it's at the second banquet that she will make her petition. All of this will ultimately lead to her charging Haman with treason. This is not going to be a simple request of the king. For Esther to be successful, this man in whom the king delights, this man in whom the king has made second in command, this man in whom the king has given his signet ring to, and we know that from chapter 8 because he will take it off of Haman and give it to Mordecai, this is a very trusted individual, a close friend, a confidant, a man who's highly regarded by the king. So it will not be an easy matter to accuse Haman of treachery. Her plan to defeat Haman is not haphazard. You look at what her plan is, and it first calls for Haman to be dethroned, defeated, brought down, and that takes place in chapter 7. And then the second phase of her plan, she still needs to go before the king in chapter 8 and appeal to him in tears for the decree of Haman to be superseded, to be undone. Her request at this first banquet, or at the second banquet, will not undo the effects of Haman's decree. But phase one is to expose Haman as a traitor and have him removed from office. Phase two will occur in chapters 8 and 9. And that will involve her appearing again before the king to undo his effects. And brothers and sisters, that is exactly how God has undone the effects of sin for us. It first had to be defeated in a single man before the community could then take issue and battle against the effects of sin in their life. Esther will now stand up to Haman, just as Mordecai had done back in chapter 3. And you can look at the seven interesting parallels between the two of them on slide 42. But the lesson for us is that every disciple must come to this same point in our life, where we are willing to take on Haman, just as Mordecai and Esther did, to publicly declare, I will no longer go through my life dominated by that man, or in our case, by that power. And we make a break publicly and declare to God that he will no longer, sin will no longer be our master. The suggestion on why there are two banquets is included in the 43rd slide. The scriptural connection to Genesis 32 is that back in chapter 4, Mordecai makes what appears to be a strange observation, a strange statement when he talks about the need for enlargement and deliverance. And Esther, this may be why you have been brought to this position, because God will bring enlargement or relief, as it is in the Revised Standard Version. And the word means a space, room. If you look in the margin of some, it's a breathing space.
Mordecai realized God needed to bring a breathing space, and that's what the Jews needed between the oppression that was being brought by Haman. If Esther kept quiet, the breathing space and the deliverance would be brought by someone else.
The only other time that word is used is in Genesis 32, when Jacob, on his way back to Canaan, put a breathing space in between the droves, the presents that he had prepared for Esau in his encounter with Esau. So you go back to Genesis 32 and you begin to look at the parallels
between the account of Jacob having to face his enemy and Esther having to face her enemy, and the parallels are striking.
Both feared for their lives. And they faced death unless God intervened. Jacob's foe was the grandfather of Amalek. Esther's foe is the descendant of Amalek. Both foes, Esau and Haman had issued or declared a death sentence against them. Remember when Esau, at the words that Rebecca eventually heard, had said, well, you know, once Dad's off the scene, I'm going to kill him. Jacob had prayed for God to deliver him in chapter 32.
Mordecai had recognized the need for their deliverance, the same Hebrew word. They both sought grace to be delivered from death. They both pleaded with God to intervene to save them and their people from the pending danger. Jacob struggles with an angel, reflective of the mental anguish he's going through that night, knowing that the next day he's going to have to face his enemy, knowing that he may face death.
Esther struggled, not with an angel, but she struggled with the message from God that was delivered through Mordecai.
It was not an easy decision for her to decide to risk her life,
but she eventually does.
Jacob first had to encounter a face-to-face meeting with God's messenger, and he had to survive that, which he did. Esther first had to face the encounter with the king. Jacob prepared presents and sent them on ahead of his direct encounter with Esau in order to minimize or mitigate the anger. And he put a space in between those presents to extend the goodwill and to hopefully avoid an immediate confrontation. So he didn't just go up to Esau and say, okay, here I am, what are you going to do? Esther didn't just appear before the king and say, okay, here's my plea, what are you going to do? They both put a space in between their offerings. Finally, in number 11, Jacob prevailed, as we learn in Hosea 12, because he wept and made supplication to God. And the Jews, we know, eventually will prevail over Haman because they too had wept and made supplication.
We can't be sure. We don't know.
But when you see the striking comparisons,
it would be very unusual for Esther to simply be proceeding in the strength of her own conviction
and making these things up as she goes along.
Mordecai had accurately identified that the situation they faced now with Haman was not unlike the situation that Jacob had faced with Esau, because Esau and Haman both represent that which is sinful.
And God is able to render Jacob's enemy powerless the next day at Peniel, because Jacob had committed himself that day to trusting wholly in the Lord and not trying to go forth any further in the strength of his own flesh. And it was such a significant conversion in that point in his life
that the angel changed his name to tell us that this is what God is looking to achieve in our life.
Don't try and take on sin by yourself. Jacob wrestled with the angel, pleading that God would intervene in his life and save him from the power that had the person that had the power to overcome him. And if we look at Hebrews chapter 5, brothers and sisters, that is exactly what was going on in the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. Just as Jacob was made strong and prevailed in his life and death confrontation with Esau, just as the Jews would now be made strong and prevail in their life and death confrontation with Haman, this is how Christ was made strong and prevailed in his life and death confrontation with sin. Because in the days offered up prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard for his godly fear. Although he was a son, he learned obedience to the things that he suffered. Jacob, Esther, and Christ are all learning the same lessons, because this is the only way God can redeem his people from sin. And the lesson is the same for us. This is how God can redeem us from sin. But it involves the same crying and tears, the same learning of obedience by the things that we suffer. We won't take the time, but if you, I believe the reference there in Jeremiah 31 points out that when the Jews come back, once the kingdom is established and they are returning to the land, Jeremiah 31 says they will return to the land weeping and in supplication. The same basis that we see in the book of Esther. Because there's only one way to break sin's hold. There's only one way to develop a saving faith. And it's critical that we understand how God works in our life, because these are the kinds of events he's going to bring into our life. And if we're not looking for them, and if we're not aware that this is how God works, they're going to take us by surprise. And the very events that are intended to save us will have the power to destroy us if we don't understand the spiritual good that they are intended to bring. Esther is not scheduling a second banquet because she has concluded that the time isn't right at the first banquet. She schedules the second banquet because she is waiting upon God. She leaves room for him to work. And because she waits, and she doesn't try to orchestrate the events all herself. You know, we can get ourselves into these situations where something needs to be done. And we figure out what it is and we go do it. And we leave absolute no room for God to work. And we do what we think is right, having left no room for God to work, and what we do is failing miserably. And we scratch our heads and wonder why. Not in Esther's case. She leaves room for God to work, and because she does, chapter 6 happens. See, chapter 6 is going to happen between the first and second banquet. And chapter 6 is the reason Haman is brought down. Amazing how she left space for God to work, and he intervened into that space. So that by the time we come to the second banquet, we would find that Haman is in terrible sorts. Remember, he left the first banquet sky high. By the time he comes to the second banquet, he is in terrible sorts. The decision's already been made by the second banquet. If it's a case of Esther or Haman, the king's already made up his mind. He didn't make up his mind at a banquet. He made up his mind in chapter 6, when Haman's true character was exposed. Esther has absolutely no control over the events of chapter 6, but she does have faith, and she does leave room for God to work. She can't control what Haman will do after the first banquet, how he marches out of there so proud, so boastful, has the gallows built. She can't control that. She can't control the insomnia that will overcome the king that night. It's not as if she put some type of drug in his wine so he couldn't drink, or he couldn't sleep, sorry. But he has a terrible case of insomnia that night. She can't control these things. She can't control what the king does when he can't sleep. But God will use her faithful actions, because God alone is controlling these events, bringing about a resolution in a way in which all the glory is to himself, as it should be. Following the first banquet, do you see the situation that Esther is in? She woke up that morning, and her people were condemned to death, and they're going to die in the 12th month. She has to go and face the king, at which time she may die. She goes before the king, her life is extended. At the end of the first banquet, her situation has not improved all that greatly, because she still now faces the trial of the second banquet, in which she has to now accuse the king's trusted friend as being a traitor. You see, her situation is not getting any easier as these events develop. And that's how God works with us in our trials. Had she remained silent in chapter 4 and said, I'm not going to go before the king, then she doesn't face the trial of the second banquet. But it's because of her faith that she is presented with a second trial that's equal to, if not greater, than the first. It's one thing to go before the king and have your life extended without having to say a word. It's quite another to go before the king and now declare that his trusted friend is a traitor. But do you see how fertile this ground is for Esther's faith to grow? And the beauty of it all is that she ended up in this position between the first two banquets because of her faith. You see, that's how God works with us. He doesn't say, I want you to go before the king, and we do, and now it's all over. We show our faith. He brings us through a trial so that he can now bring us to the next trial. Now, she would have found great encouragement from having been given her life by the king when he extended the scepter. And we don't want to minimize that. But her trials didn't end when her life was extended. So that as our faith grows, our trials are going to increase. And parents, we need to be teaching our young people. This is a godly principle. It isn't just the life of Esther. We could trace the same thing through the lives of Nehemiah and Ezra. And the other characters in Scripture, when they were faithful, their trials didn't end, their trials only increased. The exact same situation in the case of our Lord Jesus Christ. But now God is working alone, directly with Esther. There's no Mordecai between banquet 1 and 2. This is God now alone working with this young, faithful sister. And once again, the word prayer doesn't show up in chapter 5. But chapter 5 is an amazing example of the power of prayer in our life. If you were Esther and you went home that day, back to your own palace, and you knew you had the prospect of a second banquet the next morning or the next day in which you were going to accuse the king, accuse Haman, don't you think that she may have offered some prayer that night? Isn't it possible that she may have spent several minutes, if not hours, in prayer? Because her accusation the next day and the king's response to it will be likely her only opportunity to save her people. So there's Esther in her chamber praying. Where's the king? The king's in his chamber and he can't sleep. So he calls for the books of the Chronicles to be read. Her prayer, his insomnia. Her prayer is being answered simultaneously. Where's Haman? While Esther is praying for God to intervene and save his people, Haman is in his house having a gallows 75 feet high being built upon which he will die. All the while, this young, faithful Hebrew maiden is praying to her God to intervene in this situation. It's not the only case in Scripture of prayer being answered simultaneously. We know in Daniel 9, when the angel finally comes to him, he says, from the moment you began to pray, Daniel, God heard and he was intervening and sending me to you. Prayer, it can be a tremendous power in our life, brethren and sisters, and we need to utilize it, because Esther did. And God heard her prayer, and events were set in motion. If Esther went home to pray that night, Haman went home to boast. Chapter 5 is a reflection or an insight into the another aspect of his character. It's a further insight into his character. He's in, just take a look, for instance, in verse 9. He went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. He's on top of the world. It doesn't get any better than this. He's joyful and glad of heart. And the word means he's gleeful. He goes out of that first banquet, and he is gleeful. He's on top of the world. I have all these achievements. I even got a special invitation to the queen's banquet.
Then he sees Mordecai, who will not fear and tremble before him, and his disposition changes immediately, and he's filled with indignation and wrath. Same word as we saw back in chapter 3 and verse 5. And he goes home and he calls his wife together and his friends. And why does he call them together? Because he wants to have a talk. He invites them over to his house and he says, I want to have a discussion with you. And the subject of our discussion will be how great I am. That's Haman. So sit there and listen for a while I recount to you just how great I am. And he goes through all of his accomplishments. And you know what he liked best? He liked it best when he had something that nobody else had. And isn't that, brothers and sisters and friends, exactly how sin works? You know, I'm the only one that Esther invited to this banquet with the king. He's motivated by what he doesn't have. He's never content. He gauges his worth by what he has, taking special delight in what he has that others don't have, but he is always pressed for more. I need more. And it's the Haman spirit that is driving the economy of the Western world. The economy is built on the premonition or the assumption that people will want to buy more and more and more. And if you can't buy it now, you can buy it on credit. Or you can lease it. In the last 15 years, the car companies have convinced a whole lot of us that we now have to have a monthly car payment just like we used to have a monthly house payment. So we can always drive a car that's only 1 or 2 years old. And we're all guilty of this. But we need to recognize the Haman-like effect that the world can have upon us. I don't know what it's like where you come from. But my experience, when sisters are working, it takes a terrible toll upon the ecclesia. It isn't just their own kids that suffer. When our sisters are working and we have now achieved a level of income and a level of life, a lifestyle in which both of us need to work. Who suffers? The widows of the ecclesia suffer. The spiritual widows or the real widows? The orphans in our ecclesia suffer. No, not our kids, but the kids whose parents maybe aren't in the truth. Or maybe one parent is and one parent isn't. Those are the ones that suffer because the sisters no longer have time to work a very valuable, nurturing, caring, supporting work in the ecclesia. Because by the time they come home, the only energy they have left is for their own family, and rightfully so, they should devote it to their family. But if we have sisters engaged in employment so that we can maintain lifestyles that are beyond what we need, it's our ecclesias who suffer. And specifically, it's our widows and our orphans who suffer. Our spiritual widows and our spiritual orphans. The very ones that James talks about in chapter 1. The gallows are built for Mordecai's execution. And we know from Persian history that this would not have been a rope that went around a neck because the Persians didn't hang people. The Persians crucified people. In fact, the same word for gallows being a tree is translated in the book of Acts in chapter 5 and 30 and chapter 10 and 39. What Haman was preparing to do was to crucify Mordecai, to portray him as a criminal, to shame and discredit him as a worthless man fit only for public ridicule. This is exactly how the Haman of Jesus' day treated him. The religious leaders whose father was the devil, they took the son in all his godliness, the very essence of his father, the express image of his father, and they condemned him to death. Why? Because he had exposed that they were wrongly forcing the people to bow down to them
by elevating themselves. And here is the closing lesson for us,
because this is what sin thinks of godliness.
Sin thinks of godliness as being fit only for destruction. You see, here's the enmity that lies between the spirit and the flesh, because God has the same exact regard for sin as sin has for godliness. And his foundation principle is that sin needs to be destroyed